Case number 13-7032, Henry APA Assessment Fee Litigation, Ellen G. Levine, on behalf of herself and all others similarly situated et al. Appellants, Frank Summers et al. Versus American Psychological Association and American Psychological Association Practice Organization Defendants, jointly and severally. Mr. Severi for the appellants, Mr. Ogden for the appellees.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Hassan Zavari. I am counsel for Drs. Levine, Fallenbaum, and Engham. My clients are all psychologists who are each members of the American Psychologist Association. They allege in their complaint that the APA deliberately misled them into paying additional assessments above and beyond their dues by telling them that they were required to do so and must do so, and that the APA deliberately and knowingly did this in order to funnel money into improper lobbying activities. Now, the APA admitted that the statements on the due statements were misleading, and the APA admitted that this was part of an intentional scheme. I hope to make 2 points today with respect to our appeal. First, that the district court erred in finding that my client's reliance on these misrepresentations was unreasonable, and second, that the district court applied an erroneous standard for the choice of law. First, with respect to reasonable reliance, the district court correctly found that the must-pay language on the dues statement to a reasonable person was in fact misleading, and the court assumed that the misleading and must-pay language on the statement was an actionable misrepresentation. And then the court looked at the bylaws and the rules of the APA and the APO. And what the court found was that they were silent with respect to whether or not membership in the APA depended on payment of the assessments. The court found not only was it silent, but that it was not perfectly clear on whether or not the basic dues were included in the special assessment. So the district court made two findings. First, that the statements were misleading, and second, that the dues were silent and at best confusing. So far with the district court 100%, but here's where we part ways. The district court then found that what our clients should have done is to go look at the bylaws. And had they looked at these bylaws, which the court already found were silent with respect to the issue and imprecise, that they would have been on reasonable notice that the assessments were voluntary and not mandatory. Now, most of the people in this room are attorneys. We all have dues statements. We get them from our bar associations. They look very much like the dues statements that were presented to my clients in this case and to Dr. Grossman, who is the plaintiff in the related California case, which is now before Judge Bates, and who has flown out here for this oral argument. And in those due statements that the attorneys get, we all see numbers that are filled in and what we're supposed to pay and what we're not supposed to pay. And I would submit to the court that not a single one of the attorneys in this office has ever looked at the bylaws of the bar associations to which we are members to determine whether or not a representation that we're supposed to pay something that says we must pay it or that it's required to be paid actually do so. And the last thing that I think that none of us would ever do, and that it's unreasonable to expect that the plaintiffs in this case would have done, which is to call the APA. Indeed, the assertion that it was required for, when you have an actionable misrepresentation, that it was required for the plaintiffs to then call the APA is counter to the allegations in our complaint.
So there's this old case, the D.C. Court of Appeals case in Clark, which says, and I'm quoting, by becoming a member of a mutual association, such as the defendant in this case, one is conclusively presumed to know its constitution and bylaws. And so it sounds to me, though, that you're taking issue with the proposition that a member is supposed to know what the bylaws are.
Well, I don't. That is the law, and we are expected to know. But the idea that if we had gone and looked at those rules and that they are silent on the point, that was unreasonable to not be able to discern that silence meant that it was not required.
Okay, so you don't take issue with the notion that you're presumed to know what the bylaws are. Your point is that even if we know what the bylaws are and read them, the bylaws wouldn't tell us the answer.
That's right.
And then the district court said, so make a telephone call.
And our point with respect to make a telephone call is, first of all, if you look at all of the cases that require reasonable reliance, you've got to have a statement that's so outlandish that no reasonable person would have believed it. You would have had to have been on some kind of notice that would have made you want to make a telephone call. And none of them involve actionable misrepresentations like this. But even if we had made a telephone call, our allegations in the complaint, which have to be accepted as true, is that this was an intentional scheme. You could not even pay your dues online without paying this assessment. There's no way to conclude, as the trial court did, that they would have suddenly reversed course and told you the truth. That may come out at trial or through discovery, but there's no basis in the complaint, which is all we have before us today in deciding this issue. With respect to the choice of law question, I'm going to dare to take us into what Judge Schwelb called the judicial nightmare of choice of law and the wilderness, as he described it in what I would describe as the most important case here, the Hercules versus Shema case. And there are two points that I want to make with respect to choice of law, if I may. The first is there's absolutely no reason to apply Section 145 of the restatement. Section 148 should have been applied, and that's what the D.C. Court of Appeals has applied and should be applied here. But secondly, that in cases of consumer protection laws that would violate principles of federalism and create a circuit split, if this court were to hold that because the APA is based in D.C., that consumers from other states may not have their consumer protection laws.
As an antecedent question, on 145 versus 148, the D.C. Court of Appeals, I thought, in that Washakovia case, applied 145.
Well, I'm going back, actually, to the Hercules case, Your Honor. And in the Hercules case, which is a prior case.
The most recent word we have is a case that applies 145.
Well, it actually applied both, and it was a footnote.
A footnote
that was longer than the discussion of Section 145 and went through the analysis just as much. But the important thing, the reason that I think that the Hercules case is more important is because what it actually did was it took something that was not at issue in the Washkowiak case, which was there were two types of claims. There were negligence and warranty claims, and they applied 145 and found Virginia law applied. And then there were misrepresentation cases, and they applied 148 and found that the law of the District of Columbia applied. There are no other cases like that. Washkowiak is not like that, where there were two different types of causes of action. And if you look at the basis behind Section 148 and 145 together, what they teach us is that 145 is a general standard. Even in the notes of Section 145, they refer to Section 148. Counsel for the APA points to notes in Section 145 that says the place of injury isn't important. Well, that's right. The place of injury is not as important in misrepresentation cases. Why? Because in misrepresentation cases, the most important issue is the place of reliance, because what we are looking at is what state has the greatest interest in protecting its consumers and in creating an environment, whether pro-business or pro-consumer, for governing what types of representations and statements are lawful and unlawful. And this is a segue, if I may, to the question of whether or not a decision upholding the district court would create a circuit split, and I believe that it would. The Pilgrim case from the Sixth Circuit and the Mazza case from the Ninth Circuit created a broader rule, a rule that just says basically when you're talking about consumer protection acts, it violates principles of federalism to apply the law of the host state of a corporation, that the state where the consumers reside has the right to govern its own citizens, that it has the right to make a pro-business. In the case of the Mazza case, the court there was concerned that the California statute was too pro-consumer and that the residents of other states had elected not to provide such
These are all great arguments about the restatement, but I'm still not convinced, and let me give you another shot at it, that you've answered Judge Srinivasan's concern, which to me is the significant one. What do we do with Washkowiak? That's the question for us, not whether in the first instance 145 or 148 applies. I'm actually prone to agree with you, your analysis. But the issue for us is, what does Washkowiak mean?
Well, I don't think...
Get us out from under Washkowiak.
I don't think there's anything to get out from under. I think Washkowiak applied both standards, and I think that it...
That's your best answer?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, it's... I think it is my best answer. Okay. I don't think that there's a holding in Washkowiak that rejects the holding in Hercules. Hercules is more on point and directly establishes that you apply Section 148. All Washkowiak says is, and it refers favorably to the Hercules decision, and all Washkowiak does is makes the analysis under both and says it comes out both ways. It does not hold that you can't apply Section 148. It does not hold so.
But it says, it talks about Hercules itself in determining, in going through 148, right?
And it says, does.
In the footnote, and it does it only in a footnote. I mean, I haven't gone back and counted up the words to know whether the footnote words are longer than the text words. I'll take your word for the proposition that they're longer. But still, it did put it in a footnote. And I guess in the discussion of 148, it says, however, in Hercules, we employed 148 only as a useful framework. Mm-hmm. So it does seem like it places primary significance on the 145 factors. And then you're absolutely correct. It talks about 148 in a footnote, citing Hercules, and it does say that those favor one side rather than the other, as you would want us to find.
But I think that the ambiguity in Washkowiak is something that needs to be clarified. I think this court, if you look at the district courts below, they're going both ways with respect
to
this.
You want us to clarify D.C. law?
Well, I want you to clarify with respect to this circuit what the law is, and I think that you can do that, Your Honor, and I think that you can do that consistent with Washkowiak and consistent with all the other circuits. I think, and the issue, I understand you were you wanted to move away from the issue I was raising with respect to the circuit split, but I'm a class action lawyer. I litigate these cases all over the country. And one thing that every class action lawyer knows is you cannot have a nationwide class action under a consumer protection law of any state. What this decision would be setting up is a rule that you could, in fact, do so under D.C. law. If you sue a D.C. business in D.C., that Section 145 would apply, and under those circumstances, that the D.C. Consumer Protection Act could apply.
The question is whether that argument should be made to us or to the D.C. Court of Appeals.
Well, you have to make that decision here in this case. I mean, the decision has to be made whether or not to apply Section 145 or 148, mm-hmm. and we submit that there's absolutely no reason that Washkowiak does not dictate that you apply 145. Okay. And if you look at 145, Your Honor, the very preamble of Section 145 explicitly says that this is meant to be a general guideline and that with respect to more specific torts, that you should look at the other sections and the sections that follow. The comments within Section 145 relate to other sections. So I don't believe that Washkowiak presents a problem for this court clarifying that Hercules is consistent with Washkowiak and that the law is that in cases of misrepresentation, that Section 148 should apply. And I will reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Right, thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. David Ogden for the American Psychological Association and the APA Practice Organization. And I'd like to begin by explaining why Judge Bates was correct to dismiss the counts of the complaint that were before him, the unjust enrichment count and the statutory trade practices counts, and then turn to why he was also correct to deny leave to amend with respect to the three additional common law causes of action that were offered by the plaintiffs. And let me start with the choice of law issue, if I may, that Your Honors were addressing just a moment ago. Judge Bates was clearly correct that D.C. law governs here, and indeed we don't think, and we think it's quite important to resolving this dispute, we don't think he was correct that it was necessary to resolve it based on the tiebreaker as to where the case was filed. We think the interests here so clearly favor the application of D.C. law.
Under 145 and 148, do you think? Or?
We think that you get to the same answer under 145 or 148, but where we'd start is in the first prong of the standard that D.C. applies in its choice of law analysis, which is the question which jurisdiction's policy would be more advanced by applying its law. That's the first question, and then the second question has to do with center of gravity of the dispute, and that's where 145 is used by the D.C. Court of Appeals, typically. But D.C. has a power. This case involves claims against a nationwide membership organization, an association which has members throughout the country. There are many, many, many of those here in the District of Columbia. And these claims arise from the membership relationship. They are about the relationship itself. If litigation against membership organizations by their members arising from that membership relation were to be judged on the laws of the 50-plus jurisdictions around the country, it would be a chaotic situation. Some members would have rights that other members didn't have, to the prejudice of those members based on where they lived. The nature of the dispute would be resolved in inconsistent ways concerning the same issues based on where members lived. D.C. has a strong interest in the uniform application of laws to these kinds of membership questions. And in fact, you know, it's more than that, because in this instance, the D.C. law actually specifically has addressed this issue and has decided, the D.C. Council did, in D.C.'s trade practices law, the CPPA, that there should be an exemption for just this kind of vexatious litigation brought by members.
How do we know that the reason they carved out that exemption is precisely to insulate nonprofits?
They told us in the legislative history, where they explained what they were doing. They specifically extended the consumer protection law, which enforces trade practices restrictions, including misrepresentation and false advertising. When they extended it to nonprofits, they exempted membership and membership services claims, and they specifically stated that their goal was to avoid the imposition of unnecessary burdens on such organizations that would limit their effectiveness. So that's the, and we cite at page 34 of our brief the provision of the legislative history of that provision that so states that that's an unnecessary burden. So these cases are unnecessary burdens that would limit the effectiveness of these nationwide membership organizations to choose, as so many do, to be present here in our nation's capital. And so the point is that D.C.'s made that judgment that they don't want these kinds of burdens being imposed, and that judgment would be defeated entirely if it only applied to claims by members who happen to live in the District of Columbia. There would be no unnecessary burdens removed, and the effectiveness would be impaired. So D.C. has a very specific interest, a very precise interest in this kind of claim and having its law applied. And
but this court is not to the exclusion of interest on the other side.
I agree, Your Honor. Of course, there are interests on the other side, but I think it's notable, going back to Washkowiak, that the interest on the other side here, when you get to 145, is this interest in the place of injury. And that, in a misrepresentation case, per the D.C. Court of Appeals, is expressly the interest that is entitled to less weight than any other in the balance in a misrepresentation case. That's the holding of Washkowiak with respect to that issue. Whether it's 145, 148, Washkowiak, as a categorical matter, says in misrepresentations that one interest is entitled to lesser weight. So we think, and California's generalized interest, of course, California has a generalized interest in enforcing its trade protection laws, but D.C.'s made a very specific judgment about this kind of case, and in the Stutzman case, 546A 2nd at 375, the D.C. Court of Appeals recognized that a specific statute that looks to a specific issue is entitled to greater weight than a general one, and we think we have that here. This court reached the same conclusion in the Tramontana case at 350 F. 2nd at 471. So we respectfully submit this is a very clear situation. National Membership Association inherently claims from all around the country.
Can we get to the dues statement itself?
Absolutely.
Mr. Ogden, how do you overcome two facts about this statement? First of all, that the special assessment is not listed among voluntary contributions, right? And second, it's described as mandatory on the dues statement itself.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's because The Duce statement is entirely accurate in what it says. It is not a voluntary contribution, and therefore it doesn't belong under voluntary contribution.
So it's a mandatory contribution.
It is mandatory. It's mandatory in the sense that it is a professional obligation. And the Duce statements distinguish, if you look at JA 78, which is a perfectly good one of the various options, they're all the same in this regard. On line 2, on page JA 78, dues, basic dues, are identified as something that, quote, in the right-hand column, are required for continuous membership. That statement is clearly made.
But then let's go to JA 79,
yes.
Lines 10 through 12.
Right.
Licensed or certified members, fellows, and associate members who must pay the special assessment.
That's correct, and it is true that they must pay in the sense that the association considers that they have a professional obligation, mutual support. Well, I would say it's a professional obligation, Your Honor. It's an obligation flowing. These are professionals who are engaged in the practice of psychology.
Where do you get that so clearly for 12b-6 purposes that it's? I don't see professional obligation anywhere.
It's not in the application form, Your Honor, but in the complaint, which is in the joint appendix at 60 and 61, in paragraph 19 of the complaint, when first of all, you will read the complaint in vain looking for any statement APA has ever made that payment of the practice assessment is required for continuous membership or is required for APA membership. Well, that's the heart of the allegation.
But this is a membership. I mean, I guess you speak in terms of professional obligations.
Correct.
This is an explanation of what's due. It's a membership due statement. I mean,
yes.
I think a natural person who's reading this would think, this is what I need to do to maintain membership. It's after all, it's on a membership due statement.
Well, there are a range of things that are on the due statement, including the basic dues, which are stated to be required for continuous membership, the assessment, which is stated as an obligation but is not said to be required for continuous membership.
It's an obligation on a membership statement.
It's an obligation on a membership statement, and then there are dues for divisions and other voluntary contributions, which are listed on there. So there are a range of items listed there. Nowhere does APA say it was required for membership, and in the complaint itself reflects that APA has communicated that this is an expectation. There is no place that the complaint articulates that it is any language that it's required. In paragraph 19, they say that on page 60, the website repeatedly stated that all practicing APA members were billed the practice assessment and were expected to pay that assessment. That's true. Paragraph 20, third sentence. To the contrary, the statement makes clear that all APA members who practice are expected to pay the assessment, not that they're required to
I take it what this means. First of all, I mean, I suspect that we owe a liberal reading to the complaint, but what it means is you're expected to pay it in order to maintain your membership.
That's not what it says. That's not what the due statement says, and it's not what the complaint says.
The complaint doesn't go on to say that, but I guess it seems to me to be the most natural reading given the overall allegations of the complaint.
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree for two reasons. For the reasons that Judge Bates identified. First, the due statements distinguish between basic dues, which in the bylaws, and as Your Honor pointed out and as my colleague conceded, his clients are presumed to know under D.C. law. In the bylaws, basic dues are identified as something that is required to be paid for APA membership. Practice assessment is not so identified. In the document, the dues statement, practice assessment and basic dues are clearly differentiated from one another. They're in different categories and described differently. If they knew, as they were presumed to do, that the bylaws and the rules said dues were required, didn't say the assessment was required, the same distinctions made on the statement, we believe that was communicated to them that it wasn't a requirement of membership. And that's what Judge Bates concluded. He went on to conclude that under D.C. law, and now we're talking just, you know, about the issue of reasonable reliance, that if there was a question in their mind, if this was material and important to them and they wanted to pay the bare minimum, they didn't want to pay anything they didn't need to pay. The very first thing on that page 78 is the the identification that they can call with questions, and it gives the location where they can call. And under the Drake case, and I do want to call the court's attention in particular to that case because we cite it, but we don't, I think, give it the significance that it's due. The Drake case of the D.C. Court of Appeals, which is a 2010 decision, 993A second at 621, that case clearly applies the reasonable reliance requirement. It clearly applies the obligation on the plaintiff to engage in reasonable investigation before they rely even on a blatant misstatement. Here, there's certainly any reasonable person who cared, and these are sophisticated folks. I mean, they stipulate in their reply brief that they're sophisticated professionals with advanced degrees. If they cared whether they needed to pay that $100, there was a number to call to say, well, why is this required? And they didn't do it. And under Drake, they were obligated to do that before they could rely to their detriment and bring a lawsuit with all the trappings and bells and whistles. So those are the reasons under Drake, we think, taken in its full context, as this court looked at the full context of the promotional materials in the Whiting case, where on a motion to dismiss, this court dismissed claims on the ground that a reasonable person would not have been misled. We think similarly here, a reasonable person, looking at the total context, the contract, and when I say total contract, I just mean the contracts. That's what they had to read in Hercules, the contracts. Here they had to read the contracts. If they read the contracts, they gave attention to the contracts, they would have known this isn't a ground for exclusion. And if they picked up the phone. It's not enough to say, oh, well, we presume that they would have been lied to when they picked up the phone. Look,
no, I think the question is whether you would feel like you actually have a need to pick up the phone to understand whether a payment is required to be paid when the due statement tells you that it's required to be paid.
I think I would modify that only in this extent, Your Honor. The question is, if what you cared about was whether it was a necessity for APA membership, there were reasons to think that it was not. And in that circumstance, you could have called. It was required. It was mandatory in the sense that it was a professional obligation, like Rule 6.1 of the ABA model rules says it's a professional responsibility of lawyers to provide legal services to the poor, to those unable to pay. That's framed as a professional responsibility. It's expressly framed as one that's not enforced.
And the difference is that I have a look, but does a due statement on that say you must pay it?
It's not in the due statement, and it's not about, this isn't an obligation about money. This is an obligation about what you must do. So the ABA tells its members it's your professional obligation to do this. It identifies a number of professional obligations. Those are mandatory. You can be disciplined for failing to perform those. This one is an obligation, but there's no discipline attached. That's the same situation here. This is an obligation that's articulated, and the APA has explained in a letter that's cited in paragraph 23, this is a professional responsibility of that kind. The question is, when it says in the statement certain dues are required for membership, when it says in the bylaws that only those dues, and there's no mention of practice assessment, can give rise to dismissal, shouldn't you have picked up the phone and called?
And what we're talking about is whether you get past the complaint, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And in Drake and in Whiting are two cases where a motion to dismiss was granted on these grounds. So I realize my time is about expired. I did want to turn to the unjust enrichment claim, which hasn't been mentioned here at all, and simply say we think the case of Schiff versus ARP is on all fours. Plaintiffs have not really ever distinguished it.
As I recall in Schiff, the contract claim, the notion that the express contract trumped the unjust enrichment claim was dealt with in a footnote.
Correct.
And we don't know from that footnote, as far as I can tell, what the contract said, what it covered. And everybody, I think, is on common ground here in agreeing that an express contract only trumps unjust enrichment insofar as they cover the same subject matter. And insofar as the allegation that's being made is that through unjust enrichment, we're seeking to impose extra contractual duties. And then to which the natural answer would be, well, no, you can't impose extra contractual duties because the contract defines the scope of duties as between the two parties. So we just don't know any of that from Schiff because all we have is a footnote that addresses it at a level of generality that makes it hard for us to determine to what extent the scope was covered by the express contract, right?
I believe that what we know from Schiff is that none of that actually mattered to the disposition of the case. Schiff, like this case, was a membership, national membership association. The claim was that by a member of that association, that that association had made misleading statements to him that induced him to enter into a collateral contract with a third party, there or they were health insurance contracts. The court said, look, your claim arises out of a contract, the ARP, your ARP membership contract, among others, and your claim arises from that relationship. That's what the Schiff case says, and it's definitely the case. Beyond that, it arose from the contract in exactly the same way here, but the claims arose out of the membership relation in exactly the way that they arise out of the membership relation here, and that's the subject matter. The subject matter is the membership relationship, defined.
But they always, in some sense, whenever parties have a membership agreement and then there's a payment dispute, you could always say that it arises out of the contractual relationship. But if one party just overbills the other and then the other party pays the overbill, I don't think courts think that as a matter of unjust enrichment, you can't get the money back because there's an express contract underlying the arrangement. The general rule is that, no, if it's just an overbill, you can get that money back. One party's been unjustly enriched at the expense of the other, even though there's undoubtedly a contract between the two parties. But you can bring an action and an unjust enrichment to get the money back, I think, in those situations, right?
Well, I would think there might be a contract claim in that situation. I don't know, Your Honor.
You don't have a contract claim. Because the contract never contemplated
that. It's just overpayment.
And it seems to me there could be a negligent misrepresentation or a fraud in those cases. But in any event, Schiff, like this case, there's no discussion or suggestion that either of the contracts covered the misrepresentations in question. And I think if you look at the misrepresentations that were alleged to have been made, it's clear that they wouldn't have been specifically a statement in there. If you say in one of these contracts, if you say that false thing, then X will happen. That's clearly not what the D.C. Court of Appeals cared about. It cared about the fact that it arose from that membership relation, and that the claims related to that membership relationship. That's the law of the District of Columbia. Beyond that, when you look to subject matter, as Judge Bates said, the subject matter of this claim is whether something's required for membership in the APA. And that is defined. Surely that subject's defined by the APA's membership contract.
I guess I'm making maybe a slightly different point, which is that if you have a contract that says obligations under the contract are 1, 2, and 3, and then somebody brings an unjust enrichment claim and says, well, there's an obligation for 4, then I see why the express contract precludes the claim, because the contract tells you 1, 2, and 3. But if you just have an overpayment, suppose it's just a complete mistake. One party just bills the other party too much, and the other party brings a claim in unjust enrichment that says, you know, you overbilled me, I got to get my money back. I don't think any court has said that in that situation, the existence of an express contract precludes an unjust enrichment claim. And I don't know that the language in Schiff, that the footnote language in Schiff that you're pointing to, would suggest that it would preclude that kind of claim, because we just don't know what the nature of the contract was in that case and what it specifically governed vis-a-vis the claims that were being made there.
And my point would be that the court clearly making law for the District of Columbia about the circumstances in which unjust enrichment will lie specifically didn't care about the contact of the content of the contract.
DC law. That even in an overpayment situation, it's unjust enrichment claim actually is precluded.
I think that where a claim arises from the membership relationship of a national membership of a membership association, and has to do with representations made by that association to its members that induce that member to enter into another contract, that Schiff says unambiguously that not just in the footnote but in the text, mm-hmm. that that's precluded.
So this is an exception to the general restatement rule, because DC Court of Appeals follows the restatement, and there's lots in the restatement on overpayment saying that you get it, that's unjust enrichment, just along the lines that Judge Srinivasan's suggesting. So you're saying there's a special carve-out under D.C. law that these general principles, well-recognized principles of the restatement, where everywhere else the D.C. law follows it, but in this case, membership and membership organizations, that's a carve-out because of Schiff. Your argument.
I think that's what Schiff. I wouldn't call it a carve out from a general rule. I would say that Schiff establishes.
Well, that's what you're creating, right? There's a general rule, and you're saying, in the case, and the only thing that I've been able to hear that you've been able to say is that there's something unique about the nature of the relationship between a membership organization and its members that would have us overlook or ignore the general rule under the restatement?
Our submission, Your Honor, is that where the fact pattern is essentially identical to Schiff and there are alleged misrepresentations by the membership organization that allegedly induces the entry into a collateral agreement, which are the facts mm-hmm. of Schiff, I think Schiff could have been characterized as an overpayment in some sense, I suppose, in that instance, that payments went that shouldn't have gone as a result of those misrepresentations. Unjust enrichment won't lie. There may be other claims, fraud and the like. They don't lie here in our view for the other reasons we've explained. But we believe that that's what Schiff stands for, what I've just described. Thank you, Your Honors.
You were going to talk about the dismissal. It was with prejudice. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, the dismissal with prejudice. Which aspect of the? I'm happy to address any questions I omitted.
Well, I just wonder whether it should be with prejudice on all of those claims.
We think so because as Judge Bates explained, I mean, first of all, the dismissals on unjust enrichment are based on the existence of the contractual relation. The dismissal on choice of law is based on the D.C. law, which clearly doesn't allow these claims. That's common ground. So those clearly should be dismissed with prejudice. And Judge Bates found that the amendment would be futile on the other claims because the allegations of the complaint as articulated by plaintiffs don't support a finding of reasonable reliance, or we would submit a reasonable misunderstanding or being misled by a reasonable person. And as the court held in Whiting, as the D.C. Court of Appeals held in Drake, that is an appropriate basis to grant a motion to dismiss with prejudice.
So even though the D.C. Court, back to unjust enrichment, even though the D.C. Court of Appeals routinely follows the restatement, it decides not to, in this one instance, and it sort of hides all this in a footnote, as it were.
Well, the text of Schiff holds flatly. There can be no claim for unjust enrichment where an express contract exists between the parties. And that's the square holding of the case on those facts. Mm-hmm. The facts are explained in detail mm-hmm. in the case, not in connection with that sentence, but in connection with the opinion. The footnote explains that there is presumed to be a contract between an association and its members, which is, of course, the law of D.C., and that in the light of that, in order to claim a remedy for unjust enrichment, there must be no contract either express or implied, and dismisses the case on that basis. Would submit that is square holding on facts that are virtually indistinguishable. I haven't heard a distinction, really, that can be maintained between the two facts. To me, if anything, our case is closer to the subject matter of the APA contract because it's about membership in APA. But in any event,
we don't know what the Schiff contract said. We don't. And here, isn't that why it's distinguishable? At least that's why I'm troubled about applying Schiff. At one level of generality, it seems to be the same case. But when you drill down a little bit, maybe it's not the same. We just don't know. We don't know what the contract was in Schiff.
I believe the holding is that there can be no claim where a contract exists between the parties. Mm-hmm. That's what the court says.
Well, so that can't be right. Not at that level of generality, that can't be right because it has to. You have to have some scope inquiry.
That's what the case says. So, for starters, that's where I would start. Beyond what the case says, it seems to me it's clear that the claim there arose out of the same, related to, which is the requirement, related to the subject matter because it arose out of the membership relation. Here, it relates to the subject matter even more directly than there because, as Judge Bates said, this is about the membership requirements in APA. In a contract they are presumed to know, the question they are asserting is, we thought we were required to do this to be members of APA. Well, those rights and obligations were defined, whether they did or didn't, were defined in the contract. This relates to that contract in a fundamental way, and for that reason, we think it's even closer than what Schiff conceivably could have been. I mean, they do tell us what the facts were there. The claim was that AARP had failed to disclose that it made more money on
these
deals.
But we don't know anything about the contract. That's my only point. Yeah. We don't know the content of the contract.
Well, and my only submission, Your Honor, is it's inconceivable that anything in the contract really was more closely related than this. The court didn't express a concern about the issue. But you've been very indulgent. Thank you for giving me so much time.
All right.
Thank you. Let me just start off by saying that I like my footnote better than Mr. Ogden's footnote. If we're talking about the footnote in Schiff versus Washkowiak, in Schiff, the court specifically found that there was no misrepresentation. That takes us outside the realm of our case, where the court found there was a misrepresentation. And there was no misrepresentation, and it was clear that this payment under these two explicit contracts, including an insurance contract, not just bylaws, but an actual insurance contract, that the misrepresentation was not at odds with those contracts. So it's completely distinguishable on that basis. Now, with respect to Washkowiak, just to go back to it briefly, because counsel for the APA talked about applying 145 and what happens if you apply 145, Washkowiak, remember, applied both. But when it applied Section 145, it found that the factor regarding where the relationship was centered in Wisconsin. That was where the students received their loan bills, where they paid their bills. The district court here found that that was a split factor or an inapplicable factor. But if we're going to follow Washkowiak in that context, then we have to follow it with respect to that as well. And then under 145, especially if you follow the rest of Washkowiak, which says that you have to give the benefit of the doubt to the plaintiffs, then clearly the choice of law goes to the plaintiffs in California. Mr. Ogden also talks a lot about the membership organizations as though there's something special about the fact that the APA is a membership organization. There's no citation for that. There's no authority for that. There's no reason to believe that they have greater interest in violating principles of federalism than any other organization. Businesses have employees in 50 states. Businesses have marketing practices in 50 different states. Businesses do different things all across the different countries, just like membership organizations. And so,
but there isn't any serious doubt, however, that the D.C. Council was trying to do something special for businesses that are kind of unique to D.C., right?
Well,
they want to attract these organizations here.
I don't think that we can assume that, Your Honor. I think what they did was they actually added liability. And they said, in a portion of the legislative history that was left out by the APA in their briefs, was the goal of nonprofit regulation should be to ferret out and prosecute fraudulent activities. So that was the goal. That's what they were attempting to do. And yes, it's true that they don't want to overburden them, but that does not, in any, just like any jurisdiction wants to not overburden its own industries, its own companies, but that doesn't necessarily trump the interests of other states with respect to those same things. If I may, I just want to address two other points that were made by Mr. Ogden. First, he said that our complaint did not in any place state that the due statements required the payment of the assessments as membership in order to maintain membership. That's not accurate. I believe he misspoke. Joint Appendix 67, paragraph 36 says, plaintiffs in the class paid and continue to pay special or practice assessment fees that are not mandatory as part of APA membership. And so that statement is just simply not accurate. I appreciate the court's time and respectfully ask that the court – I'm sorry.
I have one quick question, which is that the way that the other claims arose for negligent misrepresentation, fraudulent inducement, as I understand the sequence of events, those came up conditionally on the assumption that the unjust enrichment claim was precluded by the existence of the express contract?
Yes.
So are those claims, if you were to prevail in getting the unjust enrichment claim reinstated, notwithstanding the existence of the express contract, are those other claims still in the case?
I think that this court should still examine them and make a ruling on whether or not the district court was accurate, that those claims would have been futile, so that if the case is remanded back to the district court, that we'll have certainty with respect to those issues. I think those are live issues that need to be decided.
So did you mean to assert those claims regardless of what happens with unjust enrichment? Because as I understand it, they only came about on the assumption that you didn't have your unjust enrichment claim any longer?
Well, there was a lot of back and forth on these claims, and it wasn't – this is one of those cases where it could have fit under a lot of different rubrics, and it was clear that Judge Bates thought that this was a contract case, and he was struggling with it in that respect, just as we did as counsel when we were formulating the claims. We think the unjust enrichment claim is the appropriate claim, but we do think that the other claims are viable as well. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement and take a brief